All right.
I will greet all those folks in the Cloud Zendo, and then those in the Dirt Zendo can introduce themselves. I'll start with Mark. Bob. Christina. Paulette. Jim. Karen. Rosemary. Vin. Bruce. Andy. Betty. Jeff. Ellen. Brian. Lori. Henry. And Ruthann. And in the Zendo, Linda. Shoketsu. Jinryu.
Dennis.
Dave. Cinda. Alice. And Domio. And earlier in the Dirt Zendo, we laid our eyes on Chris Maher from Grass Valley, California, who was in town and joined us for Zazen. Little cross Dirt Zendo, Cloud Zendo experience. All right. Well, in terms of announcements, this is the month of July, and July is my sabbatical, but there's 5 Sundays in July, so I figured taking 4 of them off was enough. And so my sabbatical officially begins, I feel like, with my attendance at the Trombone Shorty concert at Edgefield tonight. Anybody wants to come, you still can. So then starting Tuesday, there should be an email announcement going out about this, but Mick will be leading the class on the Kesa or Wagesa Rakasu verse and what all of that means. And I'm hoping that those who are offering classes and talks and discussions on the Tuesdays and Sundays in our Sangha Voices series will send a title and a description to Lisa, who does our admin assistant and does our newsletter and website, so that people can know ahead of time. I guess, you know, I'm counting on all of you to show up and support one another, but sometimes I think folks seem a little more likely to show up when they know what the topic is, so people can look forward to that. So that should be coming out. And July 9th, so that's next Saturday? This coming Saturday, there will be a Sangha picnic here locally, obviously. Sorry, no real Cloud Zendo aspect of that. And that will be in Cedar Hills Park, which is about 2 miles away from here, and friends and family and dogs. And if you want to bring something to share to eat, that's fine. But I think we should all count on, you know, bringing enough snacks for ourselves. And yeah, so please show up. Looking forward to maybe seeing some folks that haven't felt safe coming to the Zendo. And then the whole Sangha gets to participate in the Bright Ways End Open Mic Night on Saturday, August 6th. So we will have sharing from the Dirt Zendo and sharing from the Cloud Zendo. So you're very welcome to invite friends and family to witness as well. And we're looking forward to seeing what people have to share. Let's see. I think that's all I have for now. Any questions about any of that or anything else I should announce?
Can I ask you what the first thing was you said? I think that trombones.
Oh, my the concert I'm going to tonight? Mm. Trombone Shorty at Edgefield. He's it'll be at it's a 6 o'clock concert. I guess it's a giant outdoor venue where, like, you have to park and wait in line for general admission and all that. And yeah, so Trombone Shorty is a New Orleans jazz musician. Just, yeah, so it's going to be, my parents love him and they've seen him in concert before. And so they said, Be prepared for 4 hours of funk. Yeah. So, all right. I will begin today then. So, this talk I'm calling The Wisdom of Play. And as we head into the summer months, it tends to be that our minds and hearts and practice take on a lighter feeling. And for many of us, often our formal practice becomes lighter, not necessarily, but for some of us because of vacations or other activities, or just because we look out the window and we want to be outside, not inside. So, you know, sometimes maybe there's a little less formal zazen, maybe there's a little less time with sangha, maybe there's a little less studying, those kinds of things. And then there's this real natural progression, of course, when it gets to be the fall, and then we kind of turn inwards and turn back toward those things. So I felt like this was an appropriate talk to give at this time of year. And I mean, what's good about our practice is that it's not limited to this formal practice, to those things that I just listed. That's what I call formal practice. Things you can tangibly look at. They from the outside, you could tell somebody's doing that. Because our practice also has what I like to call a formless aspect, not an informal aspect, just formless, where each moment, we can be practicing each moment. It doesn't matter where we are. We might be surrounded by family. We might be backpacking in the middle of the wilderness. We might be with a friend who's dying. Whatever. Like, the practice can be there. So I thought it would be interesting to talk about this concept. I've been wrestling with this koan of play, which I will explain and suggest that essentially, we have to be careful, of course, not to think, all right, I can make play into practice, and then it's not play anymore. But there's a way that we can approach each thing with practice and learn from it and be engaging it fully, not just as kind of lazily or in a checked out kind of distracted way. So as I've mentioned to folks a few times in like sangha check-ins and whatever, I've become intrigued by the concept of play. And this is related to my own koan of effort, which, and for one of my podcast episodes a ways back, I made up a koan, you know, like a story of like an interaction between myself and my teacher that kind of exemplified my koan, like a traditional koan story. And when I read it, it's like, okay, this didn't literally happen word for word, but in a way it did happen. So this is my little fake story. Domyo was busy preparing the meditation hall for session. Gyokuko called out, "Stop." Domyo explained the monks were on their way to the meditation hall and there was much to be done in preparation. Gyokuko asked, "What are you preparing for?" Domyo, now recognizing that we are in Dharma combat mode, said, "Deep zazen to penetrate the truth." Gyokuko said, "How will you penetrate later when you don't recognize this moment's embrace?" And Domyo could only answer with tears. So I talked about in the Tuesday class, the process of looking for clarifying a natural koan in your life. And that one of the things you can do is look for teachings, passages that for some reason they just resonate with you. They intrigue you, they provoke you, you care about them for some reason, but they also have a little bit of a mysterious quality to them, a little bit of a pointing you toward growth, like I don't quite get this yet, right? Or I can't quite manifest this yet. What is this? So here's one for me, which I shared in the newsletter. So this is from Zen Master Hongzhi. And I'm going to stop after I read it and explain a few of the special kind of terms and then read it again. People with the bottom of the bucket fallen out immediately find total trust. So we are told simply to realize mutual response and explore mutual response, then turn around and enter the world. Roam and play in samadhi. Every detail clearly appears before you. Sound and form, echo and shadow happen instantly without leaving traces. The outside and myself do not dominate each other, only because no perceiving comes between us. Only this non-perceiving encloses the empty space of the Dharma realm's majestic 10,000 forms. So I hopefully will illustrate today the value of exploring words, of really wrestling with the teachings. And I think when you find a passage like this that intrigues you, it's really fascinating to just take each word and ask yourself, what does this mean? And this may sound like a kind of academic or intellectual process, but it isn't, I guess it is in a sense, but it helps. There's no way around the fact that we are creatures of language. Our minds are structured with language. Language can unlock things for us. So exploring words can actually help open our minds and move us into a different space. So to explore some of these, just to help you out, people with the bottom of the bucket fallen out are those who have awakened to, you know, emptiness, to no self, to the independent dimension. And that comes from a story. I mean, it may have been a couple different places it comes from, but one particular koan story of a woman who has a bucket of water, and she's been struggling to achieve enlightenment forever. And then one night, like, she's carrying along this bucket with water in it, and the bottom falls out of it. And as it falls out, she just, like, gets it. And so she writes this poem about having bound, you know, been trying to keep this bucket together for so long, and now it falls apart, and she's liberated. And then mutual response is pointing toward the teaching that we are dependently co-arisen with all things, so we often see ourselves as separate and are focused on our own experience and agenda, but that we are only what we are, who we are, where we are. We're only doing what we're doing in like a complete dance with everything else. So like any action we take is really just an example of mutual response. It's not just us. And that, like, later in the passage, he also talks about that the outside and myself do not dominate each other. There's no sense of, like, I'm doing this, or the outside world is, you know, coming in to mess with me. It's like we're in a mutual dance. And then the 10,000 forms is just a way of saying everything. 10,000 something is a way of saying the multiplicity of existence. And then, of course, samadhi is a good description here from an author, James Austin, author of Zen in the Brain. He says, a slippery topic, samadhi, a word so many-sided that it poses major semantic problems. It suffers in translation, as will anyone who tries to snag it with but one meaning. Some render it as concentration, others as absorption, still others as trance or stillness, collectiveness, etc. The ambiguities date to ancient times. In Sanskrit, samadhi implied a placing together, a joining of things in the sense of a union. For myself, like in one of my podcast episodes on mindfulness, I think I called it undivided. It's a sense of being undivided, whereas a lot of times we're divided in the sense of, you know, we're really more thinking about some other situation that's not right here, or we're thinking about how things we'd rather have things be, or we're not entirely committed to this moment. So when we are committed to this moment in samadhi, just a few characteristics are we're less identified with the content of our minds than with the space through which everything moves. Tends to feel stable and still and spacious. There's a awareness of exactly here and now, and yet also a sense that things are timeless and boundless. We have a fresh experience, unfiltered by labels and narratives and our mental map. Our sense of separation falls away. We have a sense of enlivened awareness, but without self-consciousness. I mean, obviously our self, in a way, is part of the picture, but we're not reflecting on ourselves. How am I doing? How am I experiencing? Look how mindful I'm being. Like there's that self-consciousness is just absorbed into the experience. And there's usually a sense of seeing more clearly than usual, as if waking out of a dream. And this samadhi is something that, you know, we may have a remarkable experience of some moment in Zazen sometime. Or maybe we're standing on a cliff looking over a mountain valley, or maybe, who knows, at what point we might have a moment of feeling like this. And I also feel like it's not an either-or thing, like you had a moment of samadhi. I mean, there's deeper samadhi, and there's lighter samadhi, and there's experiences in between. So what does it mean? Okay, I said I was going to read that again, now that we know a couple of those terms. People with the bottom of the bucket fallen out immediately find total trust. So we are told simply to realize mutual response and explore mutual response, then turn around and enter the world. Roam and play in samadhi. Every detail appears clearly before you. Sound and form, echo and shadow, happen instantly without leaving traces. The outside and myself do not dominate each other. Only because no perceiving comes between us. Only this non-perceiving encloses the empty space of the Dharma realm's majestic 10,000 forms. So today I'm going to focus specifically on roam and play in samadhi. There's a lot in that passage, but so you could think, like, is this roaming and playing while in a state of samadhi, or are we kind of roaming and playing kind of in the space of samadhi? Probably both apply. So looking into the word roam, what are we doing when we're roaming? We're moving and exploring. We're not just stagnating or hiding out or staying in one place. We're out in the world, open to encountering it, but without a set destination or purpose. Just out there. Synonyms are wander, meander, ramble, saunter, stroll, rove. So there's a sense of being relaxed, of enjoying things as you go. It's like the journey is the point. And whatever you encounter along the way will just be part of it. You're not, I mean, the whole point is you're out there roaming around and, oh, look at that. I mean, you encounter something. Maybe there'll be things you are unpleasant and you don't like, but the whole point is that you're putting yourself out there to encounter it. And then play. Play is energetic activity. You know, so it's not just, you know, kind of letting the time go by in a diversion or distracting ourselves. I wouldn't call, like, as much as I like to watch Netflix, I don't think that's play. I mean, it's leisure. So it's not just, so we're not just talking about leisure and stuff like that, but play, actual play is energetic, and it involves enthusiastic engagement with some aspect of life, whether that's other beings, human or animal, or with physical objects, or our terrain, or our own bodies and their capacities. So whether that's, you know, music or sports or something, we're out there engaging. And there's generally some aspect to play of challenge, of willingly meeting a challenge. Again, whether, and it might be lighthearted, whether it's in a game or you know, with other beings wrestling with kids and animals, or we're trying to, you know, master some physical skill or achieve something like that, but just kind of for its own sake. And it's play, kind of by definition, is completely unrelated to productivity or goals. Just, if it's related to productivity, we can start, you know, getting serious about our play, but then is it really play anymore, right? And it's supposed to be enjoyable, engaged in for its own sake. So synonyms for that: carouse, cavort, clown, dally, frolic, joke, rejoice, revel, delight, and fun. So some of us, I think, take to play more easily than others. I'm assuming we all knew how to play when we were kids. But, you know, so if one definition is to participate in something not meant to be taken seriously, I mean, I take life very seriously. I think I started taking it very seriously very early on. I take my bodhisattva vows very seriously. I want to take care of the beings and things around me. To let them fall into neglect because I'm spending too much time on enjoyable, unproductive activities for my own pleasure and amusement seems selfish and wasteful to me. And it's not just the things and beings I'm directly responsible for. I have vowed to free all beings. As I've said before, the Bodhisattva never says, not my problem. I vowed to end all delusions, to enter all Dharma gates, to realize the Buddha way. And in other places in the teachings, we're told to practice as if our hair is on fire. And Fukan Zazengi Dogen says, you have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. You are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Who would take wasteful delight in the spark from a flint stone? I like that. I feel like that's what we don't mean to, but I feel like that's what we're often doing. It's like, ooh, ooh, ooh. Like, and yet all of this is so ephemeral that if we really had that perspective, we'd realize, like, wow. Form and substance are like dew on the grass. The fortunes of life are like a dart of lightning, emptied in an instant, vanished in a flash. So even Hong Zhu ends this passage that I like so much with this. People with the original face another term for the, you know, awakening to our true nature. People with the original face should enact and fully investigate without neglecting a single fragment. I think we should really explore, each of us, what this means to us individually, within our own hearts, not taking anyone else's word for it, not comparing ourselves to others. What does the still small voice within you say about not wasting time, not living this life in vain, and yet Roman play and samadhi? What is right effort? So the bodhisattva gives him or herself in service. As the beautiful words of Shantideva's bodhisattva vow states, and I'll see if I can read this all without tearing up, may I be the doctor and the medicine, and may I be the nurse for all sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. May I be a rain of food and drink to clear away the pain of thirst and hunger. And during the eon of famine, may I myself change into food and drink. May I become an inexhaustible treasure for those who are poor and destitute. May I turn into all things they could need, and may these things be placed close beside them. Without any sense of loss, I shall give up my body and enjoyments, as well as my virtues of past, present, and future, for the sake of benefiting all. By giving up all, sorrow is transcended, and I will realize the sorrowless state. So that brings us to the teaching, which is like, this may sound sacrificial, but the teaching is telling us ultimately it's not. Ultimately, no one is happier than the bodhisattva. And as Dogen says in his Bodhisatta Shishobo, the four practices of enlightening beings, that we mistakenly think that when we give to others that we are not receiving, but we are. So what does it mean to play in the context of the bodhisattva vow? If this, you know, what I just read from Shantideva is something that even like none of us actually would presume that we're going to fulfill that vow in this lifetime in a literal way. But if part of you, you know, is inspired by it, part of you wants that to be the light by which you live. What does play mean? So there, at one level, I would say play is, of course, just what these days is called self-care. It's something that we do, even if we're totally dedicated to service. It's something we do to be able to sustainably keep giving. So, and like I've, in my formulation for if you bodhisattva practice of having three components of facing the truth or bearing witness, taking care, and taking action. So the taking care is an important part of our life, and that's our spiritual practice, our zazen, our eating well, our exercise, our relationships. There's all these things that, I mean, we have to take care of that if we're going to be in a good place to help all beings. But, and I think that this is one of the places where during the summertime, if you find yourself playing, you can, just by being mindful while doing that, you can learn something about playfulness, about like, you know, if you have a chance to relax in front of a stream or a lake, and, you know, how is your attitude different then? You know, what preoccupations have you been, does that let you put down? So you can explore that sense of yourself when you're in a playful space. And it can inform you about, oh, You know, what would that be like to maybe carry that into another setting? But I do think that this, all of this is a deeper teaching than that. And I'm reminded of a teaching which, frustratingly, I've not been able to find a source for. I've heard it repeated, and all the Zen teachers I know have heard it as well, but I don't know if we just kind of made it up in the 20th century or something. I don't know. But somehow we got this term that the world is the Bodhisattva's playground. And I think it speaks to this teaching that if you can imagine a Bodhisattva, you know, tirelessly, every last being, I'm going to, let's see, I think, did I get a, yeah, in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, all Bodhisattva heroes should discipline their thoughts as follows. All living creatures of whatever class, born from eggs, from wombs, from moisture, or by transformation, whether with form or without form, whether in a state of thinking or exempt from thought, necessity, or wholly beyond all thought realms, all these are caused by me to attain unbounded liberation. So, I mean, this is like the Bodhisattva vows, no limit. So that sounds very intense. Sounds like a lot of hard work and sacrifice. And if the Bodhisattva is opening her heart to all the suffering in the world, oh God, I mean, how could this be the Bodhisattva's playground? That almost sounds kind of cold or, you know, detached, like the Bodhisattva's taking this action without really caring or empathizing. But it's interesting to ask, could a Bodhisattva work tirelessly and selflessly and be grounded in reality, be facing what's real, but also have an attitude of play? So for fun, let's say I'm engaging in an activity that in one sense is productive or has a goal of relieving suffering in the world or increasing wisdom or compassion or beauty. But at the same time, I have a playful attitude. So to review, what would that mean? That would mean energetic activity, enthusiastic engagement with other living beings, physical objects in the terrain, or my own body, mind, or capacities. That would mean willingly seeking and facing challenge as part of the joy. That would mean my basic motivation is completely unrelated to productivity or specific goals, offered freely, not contingent on particular outcomes, even if I hope for them. It would mean that I find the activity enjoyable for its own sake, not just to, you know, achieve something or get somewhere. And if I also had the attitude of roaming, I'd be relaxed. I'd be enjoying whatever happened, paying attention to things as I go, but that no matter what happened or what I encountered would just be part of the journey. I really would love to be able to carry that attitude through my days. And I think we can all agree that these attitudes, if we were able to carry them while we were busy doing our activities, would be so much preferable. So preferable. You know, so contrasting energetic activity with kind of drudgery or a sense of obligation or a lack of energy or being on autopilot, enthusiastic engagement as opposed to withdrawal or stinginess, isolation, fear, anxiety, withholding, a sense of inadequacy or not belonging. You know, like there's something so sweet about watching kids when they engage in play, You know, my husband and I went to the Astoria Scandinavian Festival, and there'd be musical acts, and then sometimes dancers, like formal folk dancers, come out. But a lot of times the dance floor is empty and kids come out, little kids come out, and they're just like whirling around, and they're like falling on the ground and running in circles. And like, I mean, there's just some part of me looks at that and I'm like, I just, you know, I can't do it. I can't do it anymore. Like, and for one thing, everybody would be like, what lunatic asylum did that lady just escape from? But you know, part of me is just like, oh, to just be that unself-conscious and just go out there and flail around and have fun. And so that when we are playful, like, we're just doing that. We're just throwing ourselves in there and we're engaging. And then the willingly seeking and facing challenge, as opposed to, now when we encounter challenge, we feel aggressive or defensive or resentful or anxious. If my activity is completely unrelated to productivity or goals, offered freely versus a sense of agenda or pushing for attachment to outcomes or engaging other people as a means to an end. And sometimes this is what makes me sad, is that my life is full of projects and busyness and it's all for good cause and it's all meant to benefit people. But if I get too caught up in, you know, finishing it, then, you know, people perceive that. So I can totally imagine being one of those parents that, you know, ends up hurting their kids. Because I'll be like, I worked hard the whole time to make you happy. What do you mean? And they'll be like, yeah, and you never really, like, noticed us or slowed down or just spent time with us. So so that's part of one of the ones that really resonates for me. Enjoyable, engaged in for its own sake versus, you know, it's all just goal-oriented. Relaxed versus stressed. Enjoying and paying attention to things as we go versus just fixated on the destination and the outcome. No matter what we encounter, pleasant or unpleasant, is part of the journey. Versus anger, resistance, this shouldn't be. And this is what I find very, very hard. When I encounter, you know, the obstacle, whatever the obstacle is, and it's like, I'm trying to get there, and here's the obstacle, and it just does not, like, to suddenly go, oh, this is all part of the journey, like, goes really against my whole energy, right? So, if I aspire to be able to deepen and more manifest more fully a playful attitude, which could just drop in that moment, just go like, okay, so now this is what's happening. let's see. So not only, if we manage to have this playful attitude, not only will we be less stressed and have less suffering, and probably the people around us will as well, we'll probably be much more effective at what we do. Calmer, you know, not as fixated or easily discouraged, not as reactive. And if we're trying to help people, they'll probably be more receptive to what we're doing if we're not just like trying to get it done. So is it possible to create a playful attitude while still living in accord with our bodhisattva vows? And I mean, the answer to that is absolutely. And this is what our practice, this is what our practice is all about. There's other things you could say our practice is all about as well, but there's different ways to slice the Dharma tomato. So from the point of view of bodhisattva activity, our practice is all about being able to make this our playground. Because after that passage in the Diamond Sutra where the Buddha says, you know, all these different beings, any being you could possibly conceive of, we are aiming to liberate. But then he says, yet when vast, uncountable, immeasurable numbers of beings have thus been liberated, no being has been liberated. Why is this? It is because no bodhisattva who is a real bodhisattva cherishes the idea of an ego entity, a personality, a being, or separated individuality. So another way to put it is no notion of a being. So even as they're busily involved, it basically says, you know, in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, it says when they're manifesting this activity, you know, Prajnaparamita is there. But the minute they think, ah, I am working to liberate the world, then they're not manifesting Prajnaparamita anymore. It's like, I don't know, like you can be part of that flow, part of that mutual response. But the moment we're thinking, I'm doing this and there's those other things that I'm operating on. So it's really just a shift in the way that we perceive ourselves in relationship to the world. And I definitely get a sense that one of the traps that I fall into is a sense of I am doing all of this. I am keeping it together. I am making the plans. I'm, you know, fulfilling the plans. I'm growing the garden. I'm maintaining the Zen Center. I'm doing all that. I am doing this, which, I mean, to a certain extent, is true. And yet, when I'm able, not that it's that often, but when I'm able, you know, in Zazen to let go, I recognize there are infinitely many things that are making it possible for me to do that. I may be an agent in it, but this is so much bigger than me. I didn't even make this mind and body, right? This is all like, and when I expand that sense of how this is all happening, and I realize, oh, what a small and limiting and burdensome point of view that is, to think, oh, I gotta keep this all together. When we open it up and we realize how we can't do any of this without all of this support, and it's kind of also go, cool, look at all this support, look at all of this, and also a certain sense of recognizing, like, well, we'll see how this goes. I am not 100% responsible here. So if things don't work out, yeah. So as I go into sabbatical, I'm worried. I'm worried about how the Zen Center is going to do. I'm worried about how the communication is going to go and how the chanting is going to go and how it's going to feel in the cloud Zendo. Is everything, all the cameras going to be right in the Zendo and all of this stuff? But it's good, right, to be able to recognize, like, well, some of the ways that I envision this needs to happen might not really be all that important. Like, what is really important is that, you know, this is gonna go on, it's gonna be what it is, and it's gonna be okay. So, our practice points us toward realizing and enacting the emptiness or boundlessness of self. And this is not a philosophical idea we need to comprehend. It's not an obscure esoteric teaching we need to accept. It's not a transcendent realm we need to achieve. It's realizing for ourselves what it means to be a human being and to expand our experience to this sense of boundlessness, which allows us to live the bodhisattva while also maintaining, at our better moments, a more playful attitude. So I'll leave it there. Invite questions and comments. Anybody who wants to say something in the Zendo can come sit right here. Ellen.
I do get stopped on the idea of do not waste time, do not spend your days and nights in vain. I really do. I'd love to hear from other people if that sort of stops you in your tracks, because I spend a lot of time reading. I spend a lot of time in, you know, meditation. I spend a lot of time not doing any of that. I spend a lot of time staring and staring into space sometimes, I feel like. Or honestly, doodling. So I always want to know, what is the definition sometimes? It's this nebulous idea of, am I wasting time? But if I'm, if it feels, sometimes some of that, what might be classified as wasting time, feels soothing or even meditative to me. That's where I think, how should I be? Should, the should comes in. How should I be spending my time if I'm not wasting time?
Well, I have an answer that you can apply to it, every person can use, and it's going to be, but the answer would be different for each person. And that is, at the end of the day or the week or your life, what do you want to have done? And this ties into vow, because vow is about kind of channeling our life energy and guiding our decisions, because we would like to go over there. We would like to experience that, or we would like to manifest more of that. And so then we make our vows so that along the way, we're moving toward that. So in that case, like, then each person can ask themselves that at the end of this day. And I'm asking that about my sabbatical, for instance, because, I mean, in some senses, a break is a break, and that's good, and that's fine. And what I would probably do if I made no plans whatsoever was I would spend a lot of time sitting at the dining room table over Wordle and the newspaper and drinking my coffee, and that would probably turn into about an hour, hour and a half, and then I'd probably get busy with a bunch of projects, and yet, like, so if I don't send an intention ahead of time, by the end of sabbatical, I'll be like, God damn it, I mean, I didn't end up doing that thing I wanted to do or that thing I wanted to do. You know, so yeah, I guess that's where it feels like the truest way to tell to me, because there's no absolute right answer to that, right? I mean, in some senses, if I, like I'm saying, if I'm too fixated on my projects and improving, I'm always trying to improve things wherever I go, because I see something awry, I want to improve it. But I've thought about, if I don't just sometimes wander through my beautiful yard and just wander, I mean, what the hell is the point? Why have I even done this? If I, you know, if I'm just like, oh, there's a weed, I gotta do that. If I never just enjoy it. So I think, you know, the just enjoying can be part of that vow too.
Yeah, just enjoying is like productive in a certain way. And, you know, when I said just before, and Kevin heard me, I said, oh, I just spend time doodling. He's like, well, you're diminishing it. Why don't you change that definition? Well, you're drawing or you're painting. You know, it's, that makes it seem like it's something that's not a waste of time. You're making it sound as though it is. So I don't know. Middle way in all things, I guess, is that. But
Brian.
So Robert Louis Stevenson said, the most underrated duty we have to others is to be happy ourselves. And I think that there are good reasons, you know, we give a moral justification for being happy and playing, and we should. But I do have an answer to Ellen's question, and it comes from being married to an introvert. So I have a used car salesman's personality. I'm an extrovert. My wife really could be a hermit. She could. So the thing that we discovered was that, you know, I get energy from being with other people and from talking to other people. And from, I come out of that with a jolt. Beth derives energy from that solo activity, the doodling, the wordle, the this, that. So what it got me thinking about is like, what helps you amass energy? You know, so if one of the, paramitras is joyful effort, how do you build that up? And I think that is different from other people. And then ironically, once you've done it long enough, you do get a little disgusted with yourself, and then it motivates you to go out there and do something because you're like, "Gol darn it, you know, I can't watch any more of these, or I shouldn't, or whatever." But you come out of it, perhaps with a slight residue of disgust, but with that reservoir of energy that you need. You need to recharge those batteries, and so it's just different how we do it. So anyway.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Paulette?
I'd like...
Go ahead, Ruthann.
I'd like to build on Brian's comment, joyful energy. There's a lot of scientific proof that we know children learn through play, and I think adults do too, children of any age. But joyful energy can build up, and when I'm enjoying a meal, I'm playing in the sense that I'm enjoying a meal, even if it's not the best meal I've had, even if I'm not listening to an audio book at the same time. But each moment, tribal indigenous people say, each moment comes to us without an agenda. So we give it an agenda. And I'll finish with, we were on Lake Coeur d'Alene with friends when 9/11 happened. So our plan that day was to drive back to Portland, about 400 miles. So our plan that day was not to give in to the media, listen only to the car radio for 5 minutes, maybe once an hour, and to spend our energy into saying, we're here in this moment right now, making the best of whatever scenery we're with, whatever options we have. And so just that kind of bank of practicing, okay, in this moment, this is what's in front of me, this is what I can put my joy into and honestly do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruthann. Paulette.
I don't know, maybe I'm different than others, but I worry that my time that I'm kind of spending not doing something productive, I'm actually doing something harmful and destructive. And that's my concern, is that not that I'm, you know, wasting time or musing or daydreaming, but actually that my thoughts are in some way destructive and harmful. And that's what I struggle with, is am I spending my time not just doing something neutral, but actually doing something harmful?
Do you have an example?
Just getting frustrated and angry about stuff, or you know, with things that have gone on recently, and just like thoughts that are not productive in any way, like they're not really beneficial or not even neutral. They're just kind of like, you know, things like that.
Yeah, that sounds like kind of like the opposite of play.
Not fun.
Hi. I can kind of add to that, kind of in a weird way. I play a copious amount of tennis. Copious meaning like it could be a full-time job. If I'm not playing on the court, I'm watching tennis. If I'm not watching tennis, I'm reading tennis blogs. If I'm not reading tennis blogs, I'm talking about tennis to anyone who's alive. Sometimes not even alive. But I kind of had a little bit of an awakening yesterday, to be really honest. I played 5 matches last week. And although I won 3 of them, my serves were really suffering. And I realized my serves were really suffering because I was so obsessed with getting them in the damn box. So much so that I cussed myself out, Paulette, and having really bad, angry thoughts about myself, saying that I'm useless. Why is my elbow hurting? Why is that guy standing there like an idiot? You know, all that stuff. So a lot of negative thoughts, right? So I was like, you know what? I'm going to spend all morning tomorrow just fixing my serve. My husband said, what are you doing? I'm fixing my serve. I'm going to be gone for 4 hours. So I went really early in the morning to the local tennis court, and I took a big bucket of balls, and I tried to fix my serve. Do side, add side, wide, double, tennis. You don't have to know about these terms, but basically, I used up 4 whole buckets of balls and picked them up too. And my elbow hurt so bad. It hurt so bad that I felt it throbbing and being inflamed. I felt my anger. I felt my frustration. I fixed my serve, so to speak, in that like it landed in the box, but it doesn't feel good. Like I just feel so much blockage and so much self-consciousness. Can I repeat this in the next match on Tuesday? All this self-doubt, just like, it was just like a big cloud. And then I was picking up the balls and I was like, I mean, my elbow hurts so bad, I should really stop and go home. And then I picked up the last ball and I was like, you know what? I just want to hear the F word when I hit that ball. Because if you really think about it, whenever you hit tennis balls, it's like this big F word. It does sound like that. So I told myself, I don't care whether I'm going to launch this ball in the box or not. I'm just going to launch it for the full stroke of me. And I'm not going to care what movements, what series of small little things do I have to check off to make a proper serve. I'm just going to like hit it for the sake of hitting it and hearing that F word and really feeling it. And it was the most beautiful thing in the world because it was like an unbridled brush stroke from beginning to end. And I had no care whatsoever where that ball landed or what it did or anything. And it felt so great to be unleashed that way. And I realized my elbow didn't hurt. And I realized that the whole time I've been so destructively putting myself in this play box, thinking I was playing, but I was actually really working. And I wasn't having joy in that full brush stroke. It's kind of like taking a paintbrush and just whoosh. I was more like, you know, really digging in hard rather than just letting it flow. So yeah, that's it.
Thank you for that. That is very inspiring story to end on. I think it, you know, it relates to that sense of like when it's the small self trying to do it, No matter how determined, and no matter how hard that small self works, and that, I mean, like, the small self's capable of quite a lot sometimes, but it's like, it's nothing. It's nothing compared to when we can open up and let that unfold, which I feel like that playfulness. I also had that same experience with, I just could not play my accordion songs right. I couldn't have played them over and over and over and over and over, and always made a mistake, just without fail. And I'm like, how? I don't understand. And then an accordion teacher I know recommended that I do some improvisation. I just start messing around. And it was like that, I'm still not, like, I don't really improvise, but like just even a little bit of that, just introduce that element back in of like, oh, right. Like, I am not, the little small I is not in control of all of this. And really, when we let go, the results are better. So I will, I'm a couple minutes over, end with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.